You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Gray Malkin Lane Patreon. It is Pride Month. We are recording every episode on the Patreon about an often overlooked queer character. This one, I'm not actually sure is queer. When I started my research, I was for sure he was queer, but actually after reading, you know, he gets to identify for himself in his own time. We are here to talk about Theodore Winchester, or Grizzly, the infamous member of Cable's six-pack, along with Domino. This is a fun character. It was really great to go back to early X-Force issues and just kind of dive in and do a read-through on this guy. There's a lot there, but also not a lot there. We're gonna have a great time. I'm so excited to welcome Gil Barrett to the show for the first time, and my good friend Christian Smith is returning with us. Let me have you both introduce yourselves. Let us know your name and pronouns. Tell us a little bit about yourself. My intro question for today is, what's your favorite fictional bear? We're going to begin there. Let's start with Gil Barron. Hi, Gil. Welcome to Gray Malkin Lane.
Hi, I am Gil Barron. He, him. A little bit about me. I am from Los Angeles. I produce comedy shows at the different comedy clubs and theaters in Los Angeles. The reason I have any credibility to talk about comic book characters is because I was a development person at Comedy Central for a couple of years. I worked in development at DreamWorks. I was a development intern at Marvel Studios in 2008. Wow. So Iron Man and Hulk. So that gives me my comic book bona fides to get to talk a little bit about story. The first bear that comes to mind at all for me is Yogi. I grew up with all that Hanna-Barbera stuff. And I remember I was like...
And a picnic basket for you too, boo-boo.
Yeah. Yeah. And my, like, I used to watch Hanna-Barbera cartoons with my dad, and I was of the era when all the cartoons had like the kid versions of the cartoon. So there was like a pup named Scooby-Doo, and there was even like a Yo-Yo Yogi, I think, was like the kid version of Yogi. Why do they need a kid's version of kids' cartoons? I don't know, but it's the trend they had.
I mean, this is an era of like Muppet Babies as
Muppet
well.
Babies, Tiny Toons,
we also have X Babies. There's all kinds of baby shit back then.
Yeah, it was weird, right?
Hey guys, Christian Smith. Many of you will already be sick of my voice. Basically, any episode with hairy bearded man, basically. As the official Bear correspondent, I decided Grizzly was a good choice. But my favorite fictional bear, well, I could go with Baloo, but actually, let's be honest, it's Al Borland from Home Improvement.
An excellent choice as well.
Absolutely.
Lastly, I'm Chad Anderson. I use he, him pronouns. You guys know me as the host of the show. I'm also a former Marvel Comics handbook writer. My favorite cartoon bear is one of my favorite cartoons growing up was the Gummy Bears, which maybe outside of DuckTales has the best cartoon theme song of all time. The Gummy Bears. Like, I'm not going to sing the whole thing, but look it up on YouTube. It's fantastic. It's such a good opener. I rewatched a few episodes with my children a few years ago. It doesn't really hold up, but in the 80s, it was amazing.
Gummy Bears never really made it over in the UK.
Really?
Yeah.
I just thought it was super interesting because it really brought that like D&D aesthetic to kids that hadn't started that yet. You know, it was really like high fantasy before Lord of the Rings came out as movies.
I feel like it didn't quite know what it was. Like the opening line of the song is magic and mystery are part of their history along with the secrets of gummy berry juice. Like what the
gummy
fuck?
Berry juice. Yeah, I mean, was that like supposed to be a reference to did they steal something from the Smurfs with that? Like,
you know, they ate berries off of bushes and it was like methamphetamines. They just fucking hop all around. And
They had the gummy bear hop.
Choices were made.
Christian, you'll find it on YouTube. Look it up. I'm also a big fan of Cocaine Bear more recently, which is kind of the same plot line.
I love that film. You're stupid.
What are some of your favorite Marvel bears? Not like the gay stereotype bears, but like actual like bear bears. They wouldn't come to mind. I'm weird. weirdly fond of Ursa Major from the Winter Guard. Jason Aaron did some stuff with him with the Avengers recently where he's like the drunk big bear in the corner. Like, fantastic.
That's the only one I can think of.
Yeah, I guess there would have to be. That's the only one I can think of as well.
I mean, the most obvious is Grizzly, the Maxwell Markham, like not this Grizzly, but like the Spider-Man villain Grizzly. But there's more bears than you think. If you go look it up, look bear.
There would have to be.
Now, there's also, of course, the gay stereotype of bear, which is kind of the big, burly, sometimes muscly guy. Cubs are like a smaller version of that. It kind of cracks me up how we like animalize everything.
Cub is just shorter, right? It's just like less than 5'9", or what's the
younger? Cub is like a younger version of younger. A bear. Bears are a little bit more daddy-like, where otters are a little bit more like lean and furry. Christian, you consider yourself a bear? Question mark?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that was where I was at a bear event last weekend.
There are full sections of the gay community related to bears. There are bear bars where there are like bear tenders that serve the patrons. Yeah. It's a whole thing.
Yeah. And last night I was at London's main bear bar watching Eurovision. I mean, I can't be much more of a stereotype.
You enjoy a good bear event?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, it's always good fun. So lots of friends met there. So including a lot of my friends in the States.
Gil, I am presuming that you are heterosexual.
Wow. Way to presume. No, I am.
I saw pictures of you with your girl on your Instagram. That's where that presumption came from.
Yeah, but totally an ally. Definitely have attended. There's a Leather Daddy festival here in Los Feliz that I wandered into one time, and it was just, you know, it's always just sweet fun. And I was a member of Gold's Gym in Hollywood for a while, which is, of course, you know, a mecca for our bear community here. And, you know, no one is sweeter or nicer or a better gym buddy than than our bear friends.
You should never approach a bear in the wild, especially Christian.
I don't know who you've been talking to, but yes, you're right.
So we're going to be talking about early X-Force today. Gil, I would love to hear a little bit of your comic book origin story, if you will.
I grew up here in LA. I don't know if this was a similar situation in other parts of the country, but at Costco here in LA, they used to sell packs of about 20 comic books for $10. It was like everything from 1 month or 2 months previous. And this was around the era of Death of Superman. So I was super interested in what was going on with that. I was like 9 years oldish, and I was like, you can kill a character like that? I didn't know that. And so I was like, every time we would go to Costco, I'd be like, I got to get one of these packs. And that's how I built this sort of insane comic book collection in the 90s. And that was also like going into the era of Executioner's Song. So like the artwork was super dynamic, and I was just like super engrossed in it. And of course, the animated series that was going on, both X-Men and Batman. I think I was much more of a DC person as I was growing up. But right now, I'm definitely reading much more Marvel than I am DC, but I am kind of reading everything, I'll be honest.
Do you have a relationship with early X-Force by chance?
Yes, because I thought it was crazy. I was 9 years old, like, what's going on with these guns? You know, even as a cishet guy, was like, this is so hyper-masculine that I just was so weirded out by it. But some of it was just really engrossing. So I remember some of the issues that we were assigned today, I had absolutely had that John Romita art that was so, so insane with these proportions on these dudes. But the only project that I really like fell in love with John Romita Jr. on was Daredevil Man Without Fear, the miniseries. Like, that's, to me, that's peak Romita.
Oh, it's fantastic. It's incredible. I'm an X-Men guy, but my second love is Daredevil, and then Defenders just after that. Maybe Captain America fourth. Like, I love most things Marvel, if I'm honest. Now, early X-Force for me is weirdly a space I've occupied a lot on my show. My show's set in the Silver Age. But in the trials or in these focused episodes, I will read whatever because we're doing stuff from all over the place. So I've read these issues for the Thorn episode, for the Toad and Blob and Sauron episodes. Early X-Force for me is so nostalgic to my childhood. This is the early 90s craze. Rob Liefeld is the big MTV artist that is like drawing crazy, muscly, swordy like people in that era of like, you know, Eric Larson, Todd McFarlane, Wills Portacio, Jim Lee. There's all these artists. Rob Liefeld is controversial. He's not an easy guy to work with. He's got some pretty strong opinions. And there's been a lot of conversations about like who owns what and et cetera. But he came on at the end of the New Mutants, right at issue 100 is when the book is canceled. It's relaunched as X-Force. And in the last couple years of New Mutants, we meet a character named Cable, who's like the grizzled old man, you know, played by Liam Neeson or more recently, Josh Brolin, with the big muscly, like future future soldier that like is liable to strap a baby to his back and like shoot a giant gun into combat. Cable in this era is very mysterious. He is reinterpreting Xavier's dream as more of like a paramilitary unit. We will do the hard things. We will commit the murders. We will stand against oppression in our way. It's like the youth generation. And he takes Xavier's students like Cannonball and Boom Boom and Wolfsbane initially and mixes them in with some newer, edgier characters like Shatterstar and Feral. Cable is written early on very much as kind of a mysterious guy with a mysterious past. Fabian Nicieza gives us a lot of intense kind of exploration of his mysterious early years. One of the ways he does that is with a ton of flashbacks to his adventures with the Wild Pack, or later called the Six Pack. It's a group of paramilitary operatives who go on a bunch of missions together. We also get a bunch of flashbacks to Cable's time in the far future, and this is long before the revelation that Cable is the son of Cyclops and Madeline Pryor. I'd love to hear, Christian, when we first proposed this idea of doing Grizzly, what's your relationship with the Six Pack or this era of X-Force yourself?
Oh, I was buying it. I mean, I was sorely into it. I had all five X-Men covers. I had all of the X-Force because it all came with trading cards. I had all of those. I was buying this as it was coming out, and I was well into it. I mean, what was it, 92? So I would have been 18, 19 at that point. Yeah, it was extremely in my jam and doing some good stuff with characters that I'd been familiar with for 10 years at that point. I was not happy that New Mutants was ending, but then we got X-Force and, you know, I was perfectly attuned to being the target audience.
And well, and there has been an X-Force ever since, and there's sometimes a New Mutant, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But yeah, I mean, I remember buying these. They were interesting. I mean, some of the stories were choices. Some of the artwork was choices.
Once Liefeld left, it seems to get better. The story content gets better.
I mean, some of the issues here that we were talking about, the post-Executioner song, that was the sweet spot for me. That was when I suddenly realized, oh, I love these characters, and started to really notice the other writers that weren't Claremont that actually I was really engaging with, maybe in the season. I just love it. So going back and reading these now has been great. You know, I was actually, you know, there's some stuff here I haven't read in 6-7 years and loved it. But also stuff I hadn't read before. I wasn't buying Cable. Cable at the time, nothing. He wasn't the character that grabbed me.
Yeah, Cable's a lot of things. Cable's the messianic guy. Cable's the legacy character. Cable's the hardened warrior from the future. Cable's the mercenary. Cable's the team leader. We've seen Cable explored in X-Men 97 recently in a couple of really delicious episodes. We're recording this in between episodes 9 and 10 of the season one. The finale's coming up very shortly.
I just wanted to mention, you were talking about like the post-Executioner song is such a sweet spot. There is this phenomenon that Fabian Nicieza is so incredible at writing the post-event wrap-up issue. Like that's, it's kind of a phenomenon that I don't think gets talked about enough.
The X-Force 19 with the closed fist, open hand, that's integral in my brain. One of my favorites.
Yeah, I mean, Claremont never really did like a slow wrap-up issue, right? Like an event ended and we were on to the next thing. But Nicieza, like, he loves to take a moment where our characters are going to do something completely not related. You know, Angel and Beast fixing up the bar, right? Harry's Hideaway, you know, that issue. Beast driving Skin to the airport after Phalanx Covenant. And these are like such beautiful character moments that I think this to me is what made those characters pop for me, because it was like, not only did they have these adventures and have all of this drama going on, everything that we love about the X-Men, but it also like, they really felt it. These events, these terrible tragedies affected them to such an extent that unlike any other comic book I've ever read, they're like, I need a time out. And Fabian did that. And so few other comic book writers ever did that.
We gotta have the slowdown moments as readers if we want to care about the characters. That's where the soap opera shows up. It's pretty fantastic. So Cable is going on a bunch of early missions, and he learns early on that one of his arch nemeses, he's a guy named Strife with a Y because it's the 90s. Strife is this guy with like massive, just chonky metal armor. He's like Shredder from the Ninja Turtles, but like amplified times 10. Strife looks just like Cable. And there's a question going on for a while. Are they brothers? It turns out they're clones, but which one's the real one. We don't need to go into all of that nonsense, but a lot of Cable's early adventures are in opposition to Strife, who has formed a team called the Mutant Liberation Front. X-Force are the heroic version of the paramilitary unit because they, you know, stay within a moral code, where the MLF are like killing people and blowing shit up for fun, right? It's a different group of people. Love this era of comics. We're going to focus on Cable's early adventures with a group that starts out named the Wild Pack, but that's Silver Sable's group in Simcaria. So eventually they change their name to the Six Pack, which I think is hilarious. We've got Cable and Domino, but this is before Domino was Domino. This is Copycat posing as Domino in the early books. But in the flashbacks, it's actually Domino. But the readers have to sort all of that out later. We're going to do one character at a time very briefly here. Christian, let me hear your thoughts on Domino.
Love her. Wide mom. Lovely. Yeah, she could do no wrong in my opinion. And actually, I love Copycat as well. I wish she'd come back. But yeah, Domino's amazing.
Copycat deserves a Patreon at some point for sure. Yeah. Gil, let me hear your thoughts on a Hammer. Eisenhower Hammer.
Yeah. Interesting guy. You know, I didn't really know him before this read through. Interesting that he has that relationship with his family. He's sort of like our tragic figure, right? He's a little bit of like Cable's, you know, if everything goes wrong, like this is what can happen if I'm not responsible for these people under my command, you know?
Isaiah Bradley from Captain America seemed to have a lot of things that Hammer and him seem to have in common. It's almost like they're very similar characters now.
Hammer, an oft overlooked black disabled superhero, which is interesting. Christian, what are your thoughts on Garrison Kane, Weapon X?
Peak 90s. The if you can have one arm, let's have two cybernetic arms and the hands that pop off. And
I couldn't figure out his age because it seemed like there was a father-son relationship between him and Cable, but this character looks fully 50. I don't understand.
He's kind of like the kid superhero, the kid soldier, the idealistic one, but he ends up getting all his shit blown off and a bunch of cyborg shit put in place, and then, you know, things go dark from there. He's an earnest character. We also have a character who's much more prominent outside of Domino and Cable. The much more prominent member is G.W. Bridge, or George Washington Bridge, another black male, a huge character in a lot of comics.
I remember his action figure. I remember that there was a Bridge and a Kane action figure that seemed to never get sold out of. Like, every toy store had like a million Bridges and Canes. Interesting that he was a S.H.I.E.L.D. agent. He seemed to be like an age contemporary to Cable. So I think that on a status level within the group, like, it's interesting that you had sort of two elder statesmen in this group, right?
Quite an extensive history outside X-Force as well. He has like pretty long runs in Deadpool and in Punisher. He's a S.H.I.E.L.D. agent who has kind of a storied history. So we're going to jump to X-Force 8. This is the middle of that battle with the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants that goes on for like six issues, and it could have been done in two pages, but there's, you know, there's some interesting action shots. Mm-hmm. This is also the Cannonball is the Externals story, like where Sauron eviscerates him, or it's not going to go there. But we get a flashback issue in number 8, which you kind of think is, you know, like editorial trying to catch up. Maybe Liefeld got a little behind on the art or something. And we get a flashback 10 years ago to a mission in New Mexico where the Wild Pack is raiding stolen tech from a Hydra base. The sixth member of the Wild Pack that we haven't talked about is the one we're here to celebrate today. He is Grizzly. He's a massive guy with red fur. He's got kind of a leonine beard around his face, and he never has much to say. Iniciez is great at giving us little characteristics that make people stand out and make us kind of remember them, and that's kind of Grizzly's thing. He's the big burly guy who doesn't talk very much, which is a nice opposition to like the dumb burly guy that's often in the background, right? In this mission, he's hit with cannon fire, and we're going to read a little bit of dialogue out loud here. Domino yells, "Grizzly, you okay, big guy?" He goes, "Fine." Cable says,
"Plasma generator, right?"
"Yup."
"Standard Hydra issue, 12-second regeneration delay, right?"
"Yup."
And then he shakes a tower so that all the Hydra agents will fall out, and they have to climb ropes to get up to the upper floor, and Grizzly says, "Climbing? I hate climbing." Bridge says, "Christian, will you take Bridge?"
"Do not, and I repeat, do not do what you did in Madagascar. Understood?"
"Yup, I hate climbing."
"You made that painfully clear to us, Grizz. Where's Bridge?"
"Under me."
And Domino goes, "That's a frightening thought." There's something very fun about like the sleepy bear archetype. Like, Grizzly gives me very sleepy bear energy. He just woke up from hibernation, you know, shakes a tower, and I'm gonna climb a rope. Okay, yup, uh-huh. Like, there's kind of a sleepy quality about him. The base ends up getting destroyed by Baron Strucker. The Six Pack escape through Cable's body slide, which is like his teleportation thing through ship or Prosh or the professor, whichever. We're not talking about that character either. And they return the device they'd been hired to retrieve, and they're working for AIM. So we're seeing Cable fight Hydra but work for AIM, which is kind of jarring for the readers, realizing he has this complicated history. I want to talk about Grizzly, but let's go to one more appearance really quickly. X-Force 12 and 13 is where we see that in the present, G.W. Bridge Umbridge has assembled a task force called Weapon Prime. Richter is back. He's been missing since the end of New Mutants. This is Richter in his early 90s, long hair, MTV generation. There's a sentient white Yeti guy on the team, which is always very strange. There's a guy named Tiger Strike with two Ys, again, 90s. Kane is there, and now they also recruit Grizzly. And there's a moment where Grizzly is agreeing to kind of join the team. They are mad at Cable because there's some sort of giant betrayal from the past. And Grizzly is a little verbose here. He goes, I certainly hope the rest of you are as willing and ready to put a world of hurt on the old man as I am. Because if you're not, just stay out of my way when I tear Cable apart. They storm X-Force's base. Kane is there. Grizzly is holding a massive gun. He talks to Kane, still the impatient kid, huh, Kane? Fine with me this time, though. The faster we get inside, the sooner we finish the job. There's a battle with X-Force, Cable, Feral, Siren, Warpath, Cannonball, Shatterstar, Boom Boom. Gil, will you take Warpath? And Christian, I'm going to give you Feral. Grizzly goes, my beef is with Cable, kid. We don't have to fight. Warpath says,
you invade our home, such as it is, and tell me you don't have a problem with us? Tough. How's about I got a problem with you?
It's so funny hearing Warpath say, how's about?
How's about I got a problem with you?
Feral says,
that's the attitude, Jimmy boy. The big hairy bohunk is mad.
Amazing. The Grizzly says, we're only after Cable. All of you just got been duped by him. Warpath says,
maybe so, but shouldn't that be for us to decide?
It'll never happen. He'll always have his way with a convenient lie or a truth shrouded in mystery.
Shut up, shut up!
And soon the whole mountain collapses and X-Force gets out of there. So we've got a couple Grizzly stories very quickly. Let's talk about this guy, what makes him stand out from the rest for just a moment. The red fur, the massive size, the big guns, the quiet speech.
Yeah, he's a really interesting visual. I mean, obviously he stands out color-wise and size-wise. I can't look at him without seeing like just a big sunburn. Like to me he just looks like, you know, someone who goes to Miami and is just like, I don't do sunscreen, I got tough skin, and comes back and you're like, bro, you are a lobster. But one thing that I messaged Chad about as I was reading through him, I was like, gosh, I know this character design. Why do I know this character design? And I pulled New Gods off my shelf and I looked at the Forever People. Oh, Christian is like going, whoa. Grizzly is a swipe. I don't know if it's a swipe, but at least an homage to Big Bear from the Forever People.
Yeah.
I don't know how intentional it is, but if you look at the characters side by side, it's hard not to notice the similarity.
Wow.
And so I was asking Chad, I'm like, do you think that maybe these six-pack characters are all supposed to be like Kirby references? And I was like trying to figure out, like, do any of them seem like that? I don't think that they all do. I just think that Grizzly and Big Bear really do, which, by the way, I mean, we were talking about bears generally. An so argument in the column that he is supposed to be a reference to the gay term bear is that he's a big shirtless guy who calls himself Grizzly, and there's nothing else bear themed about him, right? He doesn't wear any ears, there's no claws until a lot later. So I don't know, I think I definitely see the gay references.
I mean, yeah, he's a big burly guy in a harness.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's not subtle, obviously.
Not a Liefeld design. Issue 8 was Mignola, wasn't it?
Interesting. I don't know who initially designed Grizzly, but yes, issue number 8, where Liefeld's falling behind on the Brotherhood battle, Mignola's the one that draws that original wild pack.
So I remember hating it as a kid because it wasn't Liefeld or Jim Lee.
Interesting. Yeah,
now,
I love it.
I
was looking at the credits box on that first issue and I was like, you got Liefeld and Nicieza and Mignola on one book? Like, that's a huge credits box. You know, that's like, these are all legends. Say what you will about Liefeld, but like, he certainly is a comic book legend, you know?
On the wiki, it does list Liefeld as Grizzly's creator. Before we get too off on the tangent really quickly, the Forever People, for listeners, is a group of extraterrestrial superheroes from DC Comics from a series called Forever People back in 1971, created by Jack Kirby, who was still affiliated with Marvel. They're part of a big epic called the Fourth World. You know, this is like a bunch of stuff with the New Gods and Darkseid, and we're not going to delve too deep into it. But when you look at the images of these characters, and they have been reinterpreted by several people, including J.M. DeMatteis in the late 80s, they were also part of the New 52. Big Bear specifically, I'm going to read the little character bio on him from Wikipedia. Big Bear had been married to Beautiful Dreamer, and she'd been pregnant with their daughter. A shift in time resulted in the marriage never happening and the child never having existed. This traumatized Beautiful Dreamer for a time, and in Forever People number 7, he was shown to have been responsible for the historical event that led to the legend of King Arthur. He's a skilled hand-to-hand combatant. He's among the strongest of the children of New Genesis, making him super strong by human standards, capable of bending steel and hurling giant redwood trees almost effortlessly. I'm not going to keep going there, but there does seem to be a correlation in the appearances, and you do kind of wonder if Liefeld took some artistic interpretations from Kirby for his design of some of the six-pack characters. Except, only one of the Forever People was African-American, and one of them is very cowboy-like. That's kind of like the Rick Jones version. You know, which maybe Garrison Kane is meant to emulate. It's an interesting thing. Christian, you seem surprised by that. I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Well, I've never really read Forever People. The New Gods stuff was something that never really... I was more of a Justice League International DC fan rather than a New Gods fan. So, but as soon as you mentioned it, it was like, oh yeah, now I remember just the pure visual of it.
I'm looking at the lineup of the Forever People specifically. The one character that could, Mark Moonrider, is sort of our main male love interest. He's dark-haired, and he kind of looks like Kane. I was like trying to make a connection between like Domino and maybe one of the, what do they call the female Furies, but I couldn't see a female Fury that really resembled, except maybe Lashina, but like just in terms of color scheme. But otherwise, I didn't really see any other
connection. A lot of Liefeld characters were just like from his sketchbook from when he was a kid, I think, too.
Right.
Like he came up with these ideas and then kept going. Deadpool looks a little like Spider-Man. Like everybody looks a little like somebody.
Yeah.
We jump to a limited series called Cable, Blood, and Metal. This is actually a pretty solid read. This is a Nicieza two-parter that sets up the Cable series that's going to follow. And it's a pretty good time.
I hadn't read this for a long time and I've forgotten actually how good it was and how much certain things were just set up that carried on for the next 4 or 5 years. I mean, it was a strong mini-series. Romita, isn't it?
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
This was, I don't know whether it was just before or just after, but I remember his X-Men stuff was all very square. All his bodies were very cubical and it didn't seem quite as bad in this one. So
there's a lot of mysteries that have been set up about Cable here, obviously. The Mutant Liberation Front, and I'll just do this in one sentence, also has a number of extremely problematic stereotypical characters who have names like Sumo and Kamikaze and Dragoness and Samurai, and they're all like very stereotype-y. Some writers have tried to do more things with these stereotype characters, but it's interesting. There's a high body count here. There's one interesting moment in this series where Cable shoots the character Sumo in the head and kills him. In Steve Orlando's Marauders, more recently, there's a flashback or a conversation from Tempo where she talks about this loss. And Tempo has the ability to go back in time and change things if she wants to. She gives some insight into one of Sumo's early appearances about how he convinced her to go back and change events to save Cable's life in a particular adventure. But then Cable shoots Sumo in the head shortly afterward. And one of her missions on Krakoa is to see her friend resurrected. So it's interesting to see that kind of resonance added to these characters later. We'll do a Sumo episode maybe in the far future on my show if I find the right guest. Cable, Blood, and Metal is a series of flashbacks primarily involving the Wild Pack in a series of mercenary missions. One in Tehran, Iran, where they go on a mission to save some hostages, but really they're trying to blow up a building and they're working for Tolliver, who is actually Cable's son, not his biological son, from his wife in the future who's named after his parents. Cable's wife is Aaliyah, but she takes the name Jen Scott after Jean and Scott. She has a kid named Tyler, who's just a shit human, who comes back in time and becomes Tolliver. That's who they're working for. We also see a mission in Judenberg, Austria, where Simcaria wants them to change their name. This is their official, like, dude, you can't be the Wild Pack anymore. You gotta be the Six Pack. Six Pack, let's do some shots, is their, like, call sign, which is hilarious. Grizzly is sarcastic. He's quiet. There's lots of little things, like Cable goes, there's not much in the way of opposition, and Grizzly goes, life's full of little disappointments. The Grizzly is upset when Bridge like nearly hurts him and they like riff about it for a long time. There's a moment where he smashes a bunch of villains and says, this is kind of like a Bugs Bunny cartoon. Domino calls him a hyperthyroid ingrate, which is fantastic. What are your thoughts on the early parts of this series, Gil?
It's interesting, the dialogue, because it's so quippy in a really like 90s action movie way. Yeah, that like really struck out to me. I was like, gosh, these guys are being so callous jealous about death, but of course, maybe it's a way to cope with it. You know, like, oh, we have to do this like terrible stuff. We're mercenaries, but maybe the way to get through it is sort of to joke about it. But yeah, it reminds me really of like dialogue from like Rambo or something, where it's just like, you know, you got to get a last line in on something. Yeah, I mean, what I thought about this series mainly was like the relationship between Cable and Kane, and kind of how it's mirroring the early relationship between Cable and Cannonball. And so, like, you know, you've got this like older guy character that seems to be seeking out different surrogate sons, and that seems to be a theme in early Cable. And like, just the fact that he ends up being the son of one of our main X characters, I don't know, there's a lot of like father and son stuff in the world of Cable.
But really, he's just waiting for Hope to come along, the child he can finally be proud of. The series here, Cable is not a good leader. He asks for implicit trust. Anytime someone questions him, he's like, shut the fuck up. But at one point, he breaks one of their contracts, which leads to some mercenary groups hunting Wild Pack down over a series of years. And we see some flashbacks here. They're being hunted like dogs. Grizzly goes, actually, like foxes. I've never seen dogs being hunted. I never understood that saying. We're being hunted by dogs, like foxes.
Very quippy.
I really enjoy his like dry sense of humor. He's very funny. Finally, things come to a head in Uruguay, which is again still a flashback, where Strife is there. Cable now is sacrificing everything to try to get intel on Strife. There's a disc that Strife wants, and when the six pack tries to turn against them, Cable shoots Hammer in the back, which results in Hammer becoming paraplegic later, which, you know, the team now wants revenge. And then Kane gets caught in the explosion and ends up getting his arms and legs amputated. So Cable has abandoned his team. Gil, let me hear your thoughts on Cable's leadership of the Six Pack or the Wild Pack, and kind of what this means for his character here. The mission is always bigger than the team.
The mission is always bigger than the team. And he keeps, like, every time someone comes to confront him about it, he's like, I did what I had to do. Or, you know, you don't understand the pressure. Maybe shooting someone in the back, I could have maybe, you know, told him stop.
I will shoot you because you denied, you know, like, you didn't follow my order, so I'm going to shoot you in the back. Like, you understand why the team is upset later. Like, he completed his mission, but he sacrificed two of his teammates and was willing to sacrifice all of them after demanding loyalty. This is paralleling what X-Force is going through with in Cable in the comics at the same time, where they're learning to strike out on their own because their leader's not someone they really trust.
I think at this point, we didn't know anything about Cable's backstory or anything. This was as much backstory as we'd got. And it just started to make Cable seem just an awful leader.
I was curious, when is he first named Nate or Nathan? And like, he's how early?
Nathan quite early, I think, but I don't think the link between him and Nathan Christopher Charles was
so fascinating. Later. Yeah, it's so fascinating that connection was made. Hey, we have these two characters called Nathan. Let's just make them the same person. So fascinating.
Which
the
way was that genius. Was
like, yeah.
Absolutely genius. I think at this point it was sort of, oh yeah, the kids need to get away from Cable because they're going to die at this point.
About X-Force 20. Celestials came to Earth a long time ago. They have major crazy technology that like belonged to the space gods. One of their ships ends up becoming the ship that Apocalypse finds and uses to power up everything. He finds the Celestial Death Seeds on board. He powers up all of his horsemen. Eventually, X-Factor takes that ship from him and turns it into a skyscraper in New York City. It then becomes sentient and flies off into space in a series of adventures. Cable then gets it in the far future and brings it back. So he has a ship that he now calls the Professor. That's his base. It gets called Gray Malkin. It gets scrapped, and then it gets used as the basis for Avalon, or like Magneto's base in the heavens, before it gets crashed to Earth. The character Professor and ship, the names get combined into a being called Brosh, who then becomes like a space adventurer and comes back to the team a lot. That's like in one sentence as simple as I can make that character. I'm really fond of Brosh. I really like him, actually.
Yeah. So they're basically trying to get information about where Cable's gone. Suddenly realized that the Professor is ship, and ship doesn't. While all that's happening, Domino has left the team and is basically going to reform the Six Pack. So, and she finds Grizzly at the Last Shots bar in the Australian outback. I got really excited at that point because I thought it was going to be, you know, back in the town that X-Men were in.
I feel like this is the kind of bar that, like, you get on a dirt road, drive for an hour, and then there it is. Like,
this is where Dazzler was performing during the Australian era. Grizzly's there in, I've met this guy. He's in the back in a black tank top and a black cowboy hat, drinking himself stupid. And Domino finds him there. I need your help. I have to find Cable's Brat Pack.
I went out of all this, Domino. That's why I just slinked out of sight when Weapon Prime went down.
Staying out of things isn't one of the choices that we get, Grizzly. Never has been and never will be.
Where do we go from here? That did not take much effort to get him back into the game.
But it starts to set up the Grizzly and Domino pairing that seems to be basically throughout the rest of his appearances. And I love it. You know, the big burly gay man and his hag. But the nice thing is they snark at each other. And you were talking about the dialogue earlier. I'm trying to time this in terms of Buffy as well, because it's very Buffy dialogue to me. And so that's Joss Whedon-esque. Nothing is said straight. It's always a quip.
This is my single favorite thing about Grizzly, though, is his friendship with Domino. I don't love how it ends. We'll get there. I love their friendship. We see them working together. They recruit Hammer. They pose as Valerie Cooper and General Clark to break into
the UK
in Canada, which is hilarious. Their holograms fade, so they have to like have a little combat in there. But they're gathering information about Cable. They end up fighting Weapon Prime. In 23, Grizzly explains to Domino that he barely knew them, and like, I didn't know they were going to attack. And Domino yells, "Grizzly, you are such a beer-soaked, useless bag of meat," which is so great. I love her reads on him. There's lots of bantering as they keep fighting. They have to escape through the sewers. They go after Copycat, who has been cornered by Deadpool and Sluggo. We are not going to talk about Sluggo today, but if you want early 90s insanity, Sluggo is the poster child for all of that. So they recruit Copycat, which is a big move for Domino as well. And there's the kind of the slow formation of this team.
Same as the old six pack. I mean, they're...
Second verse, same as the first, a little bit louder and a whole lot worse.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting seeing them coming together and like the end of this story where they're just like, all right, we're together. Cable, you can't be trusted, but the family's here, you know? Yeah. I guess that's in the next issue we're going to discuss in Cable 4. But like, I'm curious, like, is it that they miss this time that they were in, or are they doing it? Like, was that their golden age, was the six pack or what? Like, is it just, you know, why do we want them to be the six pack again? Or do they feel like a connection to Hammer? Do they just want to get him up and running? I know that there's a little bit of a subplot of like, we cured Kane of his cyberneticness. Can we cure Hammer? Right? Like, are they just trying to save a person that they've been in the trenches with?
I mean, this is Grizzly's second time being pulled into a revenge squad for Cable. I think to go against Cable, right? Like, that's his running plot line now, but I think it's pretty fun. I like it a lot. I mean, Domino's decided here that Cable's got to be stopped. He's gone way too far.
Part of me thinks it's just, you know, Domino was, the whole thing was a means to an end for Domino to get what she needed. And they kind of realized, oh, actually, we work really well together and we could probably make some money out of this. And then we don't see enough of it. That's the problem, is there could have been some great background characters and it just kind of doesn't happen.
There's one backstory line where they're talking about the formation of the six pack and it was like the best mercenaries in the world. And it's like these six people were the best mercenaries in the whole world. Like, Grizzly was one of the best mercenaries in the whole world, one of the best assassins there was, and he kind of seems like he's not a subtle person, not like a spycraft person. Yeah, well, I don't know that he's a doofus. I mean, he seems smart, but he's definitely not subtle. He's not a lot of spycraft, you know, but he's one of the best mercenaries in the whole world.
I can't see this guy committing murder very much, though. Like, he's the blowy uppy, you know, if you're a bad guy, that's fine. Domino and Cable seem more like the assassins, where Hammer's like the tech guy, you know, Bridge is like the ops guy, and Kane's like the little kid that hangs around and like, can I have a beer? You know, like there's a vibe about them. I would be delighted to read more stories about the early six pack adventures. I think there's a fun place to work them in. In Cable 4 is when they confront Cable, and it's really anticlimactic. They kind of just leave him and decide to stay together as a group. That's basically what happens.
This is again one of those juxtapositions between, maybe I'm wrong, but I feel like there's Sam is in here, right? Right? There's like the juxtaposition between, you know, am I a father to Sam? Am I a father to Kane? Like, that's what I took away from this part of the story, because Sam is like coming into his own as leader of X-Force. Yeah. And he's just like, neither of them seem to need Cable anymore. And maybe that's just like the best possible outcome, you know?
Sam Guthrie, the love of my life.
Mm-hmm.
So the next appearance,
Cable's hair is insane in this issue. I'm sorry to cut you up.
The shaved bits around the side. And
he also starts with a goatee and takes some time to shave it sometime in the middle of the issue.
Cable with a goatee is very weird to me. I've interviewed Fabian a couple of times. He's talked about how he has a bunch of characters that he uses but nobody else does. You know, some of them have outlived him, like Deadpool and Domino, but there's just a bunch of characters that he'll bring into whatever he writes. Nomad becomes Scourge in the Thunderbolts. Like, if you recently read his newest Cable Limited series, he brings back a ton of his characters like Black Womb and Empyrean and Courier. You know, he's writing Nomad at the time. Nomad is Jack Monroe, who was the 50s Bucky, now in like Lorenzo Lamas renegade gear with a baby strapped onto his back riding a motorcycle. There's a bunch of edgy storylines. It's very MTV generation. Grizzly, Domino, and Kane show up in Nomad number 20 to like steal a device, but Nomad's already got it. Grizzly's in like tight pants and a tank top. There's one moment where Domino says, "Want to swim?" And he goes, "After 6 Big Macs, I don't think my digestive systems could handle the strain." McSeasick? McHeave. McGross. And that's kind of the whole thing. They have a little fight with Nomad, and like Grizzly breaks Jack's hand. "Excuse me, did you say your name is Crack?" Ridiculous. It's just kind of a silly little appearance, but it's fun to see them show up. I don't think I remember that existed.
Honestly, I've never read this series beyond the stuff that D-Man was in. But I love the line after the whole thing with Crack. It's like, "Yeah, actually, you broke your hand. I just kind of stood there and got punched."
There's a couple of times in this issue that Grizzly says "mate," and I didn't know if that meant, if that was like indicating that he was British or Australian. Like, I kind of didn't know if that was like a subtle like hint, because, you know, obviously we can't hear the dialogue. Yeah. Maybe that's Fabian giving us a little bit more, you know, subtle backstory, but I couldn't tell.
He was in Australia. I just read this guy as like from the Southwest somehow, but maybe he is Australian. That's an interesting read. That's probably true, actually. I'm kind of guessing that's what Fabian was going for. If Fabian put a word on the page, he usually meant it. Then we get the penultimate Grizzly story, which is the worst Grizzly story. Maybe you guys love this story. Gil, tell us about Cable 2324 from 1995.
You know, I actually really liked this story. I feel like so proud of Grizzly in some ways, because he like always gets these amazing artists on him. Like, not every minor character, every, you know, C-list character gets a lineup like Mike Mignola and Tim Sale and, yeah, you know, and Romita and all of these, you know, I think Ian Churchill draws him. But yeah, so there's all these murders that are happening in a town in the Rockies. Domino goes to investigate because she's like, they seem familiar to her in some way. And she tracks the murders back to this house, a little far away from where the murders occurred. And she's like, "That was kind of smart of the murderer to, you know, murder people not close to where they're living." And she goes up into the attic and finds all these dead bodies, and it confirms her worst fears, and of course that it's Grizzly who's been committing these murders. And they have this big fight, and the whole time he's like begging her to kill him, which is so sad. And you can tell that he's being mind controlled. I guess it's by Genesis,
by Tolliver, Cable's shit kid,
by Cable's shit kid. And the idea that Tolliver chose Grizzly, you know, he knows that there's this connection to his father, that he's like that the death of this person, or the mind control of this person, that, you know, doing this to him is going to be like a real knife in the gut, heartbreak for not only Cable, but everyone that Cable worked with in those early days. It is really especially cruel to do to Grizzly. So Grizzly does kind of force Domino to kill him.
Let's read this interchange. Gil, will you read Domino, because you have such a high soprano voice?
Oh, thank you.
She's finally got him cornered. She's realizing he's not in control of his actions. And she says,
"Now please get up slowly. We've all lost control at some time in our lives. It's part of this insane business we're in, where life and death are so close you could barely put a straight edge razor between them. But Theo, the man I know you to be, who has watched my back in countless battles, would never give up hope."
And he's crying. "Don't you understand? I remember all the horrible things he made me do. That will never go away. Dom, if you care for me at all, pull the trigger."
"No! There's something you're not telling me. What are you hiding? I know, Grizzly, this isn't like you. Listen, I don't have that many friends, particularly ones that go back as far as you. And it may sound selfish, but I'm not ready to let you go."
And there's a weird flashback here that looks like Domino is holding up a picture of Grizzly in front of a giant head of Grizzly. It's super baffling, but you get the idea. Like, maybe she's showing him a photograph. I really don't know. He reaches out and is like gonna kill her, or like maybe trying to scare her into killing him because he wants to die, but also maybe Tolliver's just messing with his head. And she says,
"Why? Why did it have to be this way?"
And as he's dying, "It was Tyler. He made me like this, used his powers. No way out. Don't tell Nathan. It'll only hurt him." And she buries him in a stony grave. Now, there's a lot of stories like this where superheroes are driven to murder because they've been mind controlled by like the puppet master or the ringmaster or Mesmero or some shit. Or more recently, you know, Nightcrawler, like Orcus drove him crazy and made him kill a bunch bunch of people. Like, that's always a rough story. The reason I don't like this story is for two reasons. Number one, Grizzly dies in the end, which I think is super annoying. And number two, it's Tolliver. Like, it's Tolliver. If it was Strife, maybe it would have some impetus to me, but it's fucking Tolliver. Fable's fucking son. I hate it.
See, I've never read this. I had no idea. But I didn't know where this was going. I'd stopped reading at this point. It was like post-Age of Apocalypse. I was kind of out for a while. Cable was not a title I went back to. So suddenly he was dead. Cable's going to like come back and clear his mind or something. And no, he's under a grave. And it's like, oh, all right then. But it really does feel like he's just been killed to further Domino's plot at this point. You know, Domino's going back to X-Force. So let's, you know, give her a bit of trauma and something to flash back to later.
But it did work, you know, as a single issue and like the pathos of it. And, you know, this Tim Sale art really does sell it for me. It's interesting, like how his design changes here, where he's a little more saber-toothy. He's a little more feral and like wolf-like or cat-like, as opposed to just sort of like gorilla man that he was before. That's what I noticed.
That Tim Sale art on that, where you see all the bodies, it really sells the horror vibe going on this one.
For sure. I thought it was a sad way to end him. I mean, you know, as much as like there's sort of hints towards development, we know he's a funny guy, we know that he's like dry, we know that he's sort of like strong and silent, but like we don't know anything about him. Now we know that his name is Theodore. This is the first time we know that in this story. So like, we, you know, it's sort of that Game of Thrones thing where you finally learn someone's name and you know they're gonna die that episode, you know.
I like this story for what it means for Domino, but I hate that Grizzly is the one that gets fridged for her. I mean, at least it's the male character, not the female character, I guess. But Grizzly's a character I'm really fond of. There's a list of characters that we all have that we love, and there's a list of characters we're ambivalent about, and there's a list of characters we hate. Tolliver or Tyler Dayspring is on my fucking hate list. I hate this so much. He deserves a Patreon as well one day. We will talk about it at some point, but my list is long. Grizzly gets brought up a few times, you know, for like motivations for Domino. In X-Force and Cable 95, the annual, Domino is like getting taunted by Arcade. He like makes a robot of Grizzly to taunt her that she has to kill. We get a flashback of Grizzly in the Deadpool and Cable Split Second Infinite comic number 5 that kind of shows when he first gets recruited to the team. And then he's resurrected on Krakoa. He shows up in Excalibur 4, volume 4, number 1. He's just like in the Green Lagoon. We also see him in Women of Marvel, volume 2, number 1, where he's just kind of a background character. So he completely exists in the Marvel Universe. What are your thoughts? What do you think Grizzly liked about Krakoa, Christian?
Just the general vibe. I like the fact that he became a bit of a cameo queen. You can stick him in the back of a background and you know exactly who it is. But, you know, he just got to live his life, not have to worry about doing anything, and just, you know, hung out and probably got to hang out with Domino and generally just catch up on the TV he hasn't seen for 10 years.
Krakoa, there's no money. You just get to hang out and, like, have orgies. We've never seen Grizzly as a sexual character, nor has his sexuality ever been discussed on the page. It's fun to read him as the queer character because of the harness and the bear stereotype and, like, Domino being his fruit fly. Like, that's funny to me. But there's one reason he's been primarily associated with being gay, and that's because of Mr. Steve Fox, my friend and friend of the show. In X-Men 92, House of 92, Gil, is this a series that you read when it was coming out a few years ago?
Yeah, I loved the reinterpretation. It was such a great way to, like, review the Krakoa era, you know?
It's Krakoa, but, like, only using 90s characters and chronology. It's interesting.
Yeah, so, like, what a great way to just catch you up on what's going on in Krakoa through this, like, alternate lens. I just loved that as a conceit. I thought it was so smart.
The Marauders in this version of reality is just a ship full of, like, gay heroes. It's Northstar, Shatterstar, Richter, and Iceman, and Grizzly. One panel, he doesn't talk, but he's on the ship full of gay guys, and you just kind of get the vibe that that's how he's always been. Because we're doing a Pride special on him, we gotta talk about his queerness.
And it was this one panel. It was one of those things that when the panel came out and we saw it, it was like, oh yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And then everyone said, but we've never seen anything about him. He's not been gay before. And it's like, yeah, but he is now. That's fine. Put him on the boat with Kitty and the rest of the gays. It's fine. Yeah. But I kind of love it for him.
What's the Grizzly story that you wish you had? What's a way that you would like to see this character incorporated or explored by modern storytellers? Gil, do you have any ideas here?
I mean, really anything that takes it from his point of view, you know, because he's really a side character in so many other stories. You know, in that Deadpool issue, the Infinity comic that we talked about, the flashback to him is him meeting Domino, and he's already with Bridge at that point. So, okay, we know that he and Bridge had a relationship first. So that at least gives us some hint of chronology. chronology. I would love to know how he got involved with the six pack. I liked your description of him as like the demolitions expert of this team. So, you know, thinking of the six pack in kind of an Ocean's 11-y, Dirty Dozen-y kind of way, it might be interesting to see them on like an early adventure pre-Cable or maybe post-Cable. And like, what does it look like as they go forward and like do some A-team shit together? And, you know, he gets to like, just anything that gives him a real character.
So
would be great.
We're putting together a team or a squad of mutants that's like the classic stereotypes of the different power sets mixed together. And every team has the strong guy in the back, right? The X-Men, there is literally Strong Guy or Warpath, who often fulfills this role. If we're putting together a side team and we need a strong guy, Grizzly falls on that list of characters that could easily be used. But I don't know that he's at the top of anyone's list. I think people would really have to care about him, but I do think he's fun and there's enough about him that makes him really interesting to explore. Colossus is the standard version of this. Colossus is the guy made of steel who doesn't want to kill. He just wants to paint. But Grizzly is not Colossus. Grizzly is a mercenary. However, if I was putting together my own team, my first character that would fulfill the strong guy spot is Blob, because I just have so many Blob stories I want to tell. The second one I would use is Forearm, who I'm enormously fond of, which is ridiculous because Forearm...
They have the same headdress, him and Grizzly. They have the same hat.
Exactly. Same harness.
That's definitely like a Kirby like homage too.
But in a universe that's so oversaturated with characters, he is unique, but also has that same power set, right? There's nothing kind of quite to set him off outside of his relationships to Domino. When Gail Simone wrote Domino, that would have been the perfect place to see Grizzly show up.
He's also bright red. I mean, maybe a story where he learns about sunscreen.
In a world full of blue characters and green characters, you know, it's fun to have a red guy on the page.
Guys, we are here in LA. You know what we say in LA? We say melanoma. We say melano, thank you. Let's do SPF 70 or above, guys. Do not go outside without this sunscreen. We're here on Mother's Day. My mom was an esthetician. Do you know what would have happened if I left the house without sunscreen? Oh, yeah, for sure. I would have died. I would be dead.
I mean, Grizzly has fur, not the same, but I do hear you. It is a funny read.
I kind of want to see him just hanging out now with Domino. Let them do some, not quite as Black Ops as we've had previously, but actually the Domino of Hot Shots and Gail Simone writing her.
Yeah.
I think she'd be able to write a great Grizzly, you know, that snark, the banter. But yeah, just let him be, honestly, give him a thought bubble. We haven't actually had a thought bubble of his. Everything has been ever. Surface. So have no guys, thought bubble. So some interiority would be great.
Have you guys been reading the current Birds of Prey run?
Yes, love it.
Super, super good. Like, imagine Grizzly kind of taking on that Big Barda role and like having these, like, the way Big Barda calls Batgirl, you know, small bat, you know, kind of feels like, you know, I don't think Grizzly is like a simple character, but I think that, you know, that he certainly would just like, just to mess with someone, be like, you're small and I'm just going to call you small.
I'm fond of him very much. I don't know that we'll ever see him in a feature role, but I would be thrilled to see Domino as part of X-Force has like a little side mission where she calls Grizzly in, or even, you know, she's hanging out with him in a gay club and trying to help him get laid. Like, if I saw him in one page that just kind of explored that relationship or his queerness, I think it would be delightful. I would smile ear to ear. He's a character that I'm fond of. And out of the six pack, I think outside of Domino, he's the best member. So we're going to kind of wrap up our conversation here. If you have any final thoughts on Grizzly, I'd love to hear them. As we are wrapping up, we're going to put this out on the Patreon initially on June 13th. Where can people find you both online? And is there anything you'd like to plug as far as stuff that you are doing or promoting?
As usual, you know, I don't have anything to plug, but friends do. So you check my socials, my Instagram and Blue Sky, Chrissy1701 on both of those. Beyond that, the usual, pay your drag queens, make sure you vote. All good.
Pay your drag queens and make sure you vote in that order.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And Gil?
For sure. I always have a show going on. Please come to LA if you're in town. Come see our live shows. We do a show with Jody Sweetin from Full House. It's called Family Dinner. That is a show where comedians come and they bring a food that was important to them growing up, and they literally have family dinner on stage and the audience gets fed too. We usually do that at the Bourbon Room, but you can find out, you know, all of our dates and locations at Fam Din Show on all the socials. That's Family Dinner Show. And the other show we do is is a fun game show at UCB with Jimmy Pardo from the Conan O'Brien show. It's sort of like At Midnight. It's just comedians do fun challenges. And of course, we've had giant comedians like Paul F. Tompkins and Sarah Silverman, who's been on, and Andy Richter, and a million wonderful people. And we do that at UCB. That's usually the second Saturday of the month. But you can find out all about that show at Pop Cultured Game on all the socials.
It's so fun building a network on this show. Next time I'm in LA, I'll make sure we say hi. You've got a great presence. It's just really nice to meet you, man. Next Patreon is going to be all about the character Cloud, who is a non-binary icon with some dear friends of mine, including an interview with Al Ewing as part of that. It's phenomenal. I just recorded it the other day. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Thank you, Christian. Thank you, Gil. We will see you back here next time.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again. You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Life's better with American Family Insurance. Because we know in making the most of your home, DIY doesn't just stand for do it yourself. It also means dream it yourself. And we're here to help protect the dreams you're building. Save up to 23% when you bundle home and auto. American Family Insurance. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Gray Malkin Lane Patreon channel. I am so excited to be meeting a new friend that I've been interacting with online for ages, the incredible Risa Rococo, who I have befriended through Instagram. And Risa, it's wonderful to meet you. Tell me and our listeners a little bit about yourself and your origin story, if you are willing to share.
Sure. So I feel like my comic book origin story starts with third grade or so. My uncle had a comic book store in the now defunct Hawthorne Mall in Southern California. And he's an airbrush artist, muralist, and all of that. But he would bring in like boxes of comics each week, and I had to put them out like on the racks. And so I read everything. And also that was around the time of like the X-Men cartoon a little bit, like elementary school. And I read everything, and I'd like watch the show and be like, that's not comic accurate. So like really got into it from there. Kind of stopped reading comics a little while, like in high school, but like always wanted to go to Comic-Con and stuff. It just never happened. And then I would say like when the movies started coming out, like Iron Man, Spider-Man and everything, I was super duper into that. Not DC as much, but my uncle loves Batman. So I saw all of those, and he got me into like Star Wars and Star Trek. And all, so it was just a cascading nerd, you know, extravaganza. But I love X-Men the most. I've got several of the like Funko Pops and t-shirts, and like, I don't know what happened to any of my comics. I think they're all missing, but definitely this has always been like a very fond place in my heart.
There are full nerd universes out there. It's been interesting. Truly. As my kids have gotten used to me making this show, their conversations about their own fandoms and interests have really changed.
Yeah.
My oldest is super into The Legend of Zelda. The youngest was really into Pokemon and Last Airbender. And they've kind of started creating their own little worlds. This mythology of characters is a wonderful nerd space. Now, you do performance as well. Tell everybody a little bit about your performance work.
Yeah, so I always liked dancing. And just like kind of fell out of it in high school. I went to a burlesque show last year, like last January, and I was like, oh my God, this is so cool. These women are so badass. Like, I think I could do that. As I'm taking classes, I realized there's nerdlesque. So people dress up as like the May is crazy. There are Star Wars shows everywhere. I had a friend dress up as Jabba the Hutt and then like strip out of that. And like they make these super duper, like really creative costumes that are super like homemade DIY. And so I would say, it's a real blend of like cosplay and like dance. Like that is such an interesting field, and there's a like festival in Minneapolis for it and stuff. So I'm really kind of leaning towards that way. And so I'm like working on an Electra costume, because I feel like everybody goes towards Storm, and then they do like, you know, all the super well known people. I'm like, Electra's easy. It's just like a red outfit. I can do that. And then as far as like Star Wars, I'm thinking like Lando Calrissian, because I have not seen anyone do that. So it's kind of hard to like find something no one else has done. Like there are a lot of Uhuras, for instance, or like Mirror Universe Uhuras, but you kind of just take it and make it your own. And I don't think people are super precious about like, oh, I did that, so you can't do it. So it's a super welcoming and creative space, and it's been great.
There are full nerd universes out there once again. I have befriended drag queens and burlesque performers and cosplayers.
Yeah.
Most of them have day jobs, but they do this at a professional level on the side, which is a fantastic thing. I love hearing you embrace that nerd stuff. I love hearing the body positivity and just, what is it about performance that you get? What do you get out of performance?
Yeah, in my job, my muggle job, I'm super behind the scenes. I do a lot of event planning and fundraisers. And so I do my best to like stay off stage, find other people to like introduce speakers and all of that, which I really love the process of putting things together. But when I saw the women performing last year, I was just like, can I do that? Like, is that a thing I can do? And so far I've mostly had virtual performances. So it's weird because you don't get that immediate audience feedback, but also it's less intimidating because you don't have to worry about someone booing you or like, you know, if you make a mistake, it's not like you're going to get, you know, tomatoes thrown in front of you in an audience. But this year have like a festival coming up at like Labor Day weekend in Reading. And so that'll be on a stage in front of people, like a fairly decent crowd and stuff. So it's really like an opportunity to break out of my shell. I'm fairly introverted, and to like force myself to do a project. Like I think I have ADD. Like I've been talking to a coworker and we're like, we both have it. And like, just were never diagnosed as kids. And so it's like, okay, there's a deadline and I have to do all of this like project planning to make it happen up to the deadline and stuff. And so it's been like a really good practice for me to just like be able to stop procrastinating. And it's something fun, it's less, you know, arduous.
Now, I know you're not a big comics person. You love the X-Men, and the X-Men exist all over the place. We have interacted mostly on my show because I post a lot of crazy X-Men stuff online that you really enjoy to interact with. I know you're not a person who listens to a lot of the show, but what's your relationship with the X-Men like as a fan? Who are your characters? What are the sweet spots for you?
So I don't feel like I've ever really had a favorite character. I love them as an ensemble. I love Gambit. I love Storm. I love Wolverine. I'm so excited about Deadpool. I really feel like the movies didn't do a lot of those characters justice, or like some of the ones I really love, I still haven't seen on screen. And then there's been like the shows, like they had that terrible Gen X pilot. Like I was really thrilled about that because I loved Generation X when that came out. I love all of those characters too. And so I'm just hoping that like we get to see more of that with the like merging and all of that. And now it's under Disney. I want to say like I was always kind of annoyed by the younger folks like Jubilee and like Shadowcat. I'm like, oh my God, like find some adults. They shouldn't be here. Because it was always weird to me, like you're in a school, but you're the only kid. But in the movies, there's like all these kids, like what's going on? And I would say like, I'm starting to like Rogue more. And it might be because of like the cartoon. It was just so well done, the X-Men 97. And I'm like, oh, she's really badass. Like I love her. And I forgot. So I definitely would say those are my top, but I mean, I love them all. It's like,
excellent. Excellent. So we are featuring women of color on my show in July. Mm-hmm. And over on the Patreon channel, we are having conversations about more obscure characters. Now, when I assembled my list of women of color who are mutants or adjacent to the X-Men, I had to pick five for the Patreon. We put an episode out every Wednesday. There's five ones. Mm-hmm. And we're covering some incredible characters like Charlotte Jones and Bling. The one that's going to surprise people most is this character, because this is one that's very often overlooked and is relatively obscure. But there's a particular conversation about this character that I think is really fascinating. There's about 40 other characters on the list still that I'll get to another time. But today we're here to talk about a character who has no other name than Punch-Out, which is a terrible code name. When I was a kid growing up, we had one of the original Nintendo systems and we played Mike Tyson's Punch-Out, and I remember King Hippo, and I
I bet that's where it came from.
I mean, maybe. It's very 80s-ish. Punch-Out is not a character you were really familiar with, nor am I going to presume Genosha is a place that you're very familiar
with. No, I actually know, like, this is a newer, or I guess it's old, but like, I didn't remember this version of Genosha. I just remember it as like mutants living there and like not being slaves. So like, it was really great to read these issues and realize like, oh no, they had like a thriving muggle population, and then like, you know, I'm sure they're going to break out of that, but that I like have read a lot of the lore.
Did you watch X-Men 97?
I did, like,
yeah. So Genosha, the home of the massacre, which is an actual story from the comics. Genosha starts here, though. This is a Chris Claremont creation. It's made in 1988. It's an island off the east coast of Africa, relatively close to Madagascar. Is like, it's a fictional place, obviously, where a particular form of Western government had established rule and created like a deep caste system where white people are in charge primarily, and there's only a few black people around. But it's a commentary on South Africa and apartheid. Absolutely. But it's clearly meant to be mutants versus humans. But most of the mutants who are in charge, or the people who are in charge, are still white. There's a guy
Did you see the commercial? And they were like, people of all colors get along.
Yeah,
but like,
yeah. And then you get there and they want to...
Right.
You get there and they want to take your mind, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. They call it the Green and Pleasant Land. It's a place where mutants at birth, if detected, will be put into a particular pool where over time, as their powers are learned, they have control collars put on them and they are made to serve with whatever the country thinks is the best, as soldiers, as laborers, as leisure workers, as servants, whatever it is, where there are only a very few mutants who are allowed kind of freedom in the top piece of the government. And this group is called the Press Gang. And the Press Gang is a group of mutants who buy into all of this. They are allying themselves in a slave-cased system that allows them to have privilege. Mm-hmm. And of the Press Gang, it's mostly white guys. We got Pipeline and Hawkshaw and some others people will know. But one of them that is oft overlooked is Punch-Out, who is a black female mutant who's a little like Frenzy, for those that know Frenzy, in that she's a big kind of She-Hulky black woman.
Yeah.
Punch you in the face and you're gonna get knocked down. What are your thoughts on what it was like to step into Genosha and kind of see this caste system present there?
So I'm glad you explained that, because I kept seeing Press Gang and I was like, who is that? Like, is it the actual press? What's happening?
Yeah, so the magistrates are the ruling group. They're the upper class in Genosha, with the Gene-Geneer, who is literally a Dr. Moreau with experimenting, kind of the guy behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. The Press Gang are the mutants who serve the Gene-Geneers or work with
them.
I don't think the Press Gang would
Overseers who were like black. It's like, okay, we're going to let you be in charge, but you get a little bit of like, you know, free time.
You get privilege in return for service. Yeah.
Right, right. So I thought like, oh, this is weird. She's like entirely the muscle. She doesn't have much to say. I'm not sure if she's like a Grace Jones cut. I think they really liked her and like made her a bunch of different characters in the 80s, but it was just like, boy, I wish she had more to do. And I think in the episodes you sent me, or the issues, she's in maybe two like scenes each. Like, she doesn't show up very much. And I think it's interesting that like Rogue absorbed her powers and stuff. I was like, oh, are they going to do more with that and show her like depowered? And that didn't really happen. So yeah, I thought, boy, she's ripped. Like, what kind of workout is she doing? I need that. And then
it
also
might just be part of her mutant power. She's got like perfect body and metabolism.
Yeah. Well, that's what they were saying. Rogue like grew to like take on, you know, her muscle mass or whatever. So I wonder if she shows up more, because I'm now interested in like reading more about her. But also like, I'm realizing there's a ton of about Genosha I don't know, so I need to like buy an encyclopedia of that, because it's super interesting. But Genosha, you know, I've been to South Africa a few times, and like instantly it was like, oh my god, this is like exactly what, you know, was going on.
I have never been to South Africa. What was
highly
it like
recommend
see, what was it like to see? I can't really travel because I got little kids, but there will come a day when I can travel.
Yeah.
They're teenagers almost. We're getting there, 15 and 12, so I'm forward
to
my 50s.
It's like I the first place I went was Cape Town, and it was like Santa Monica, like, you know, walkable kind of beaches, wonderful restaurants, good shopping and stuff. And then of course there are the townships, you know, that are like further inland, but like really easy to navigate with kids. Maybe it's a long flight, but you know, you stop in Europe and go. And so I was there for like a week with a group, and then on my own like a few years later I went to Johannesburg, and that's where you really see like the history is everywhere. Like there are museums and monuments and tours and all of that. I spent a day in Soweto, and so they have like a museum about like the uprising, the mass massacre, the students and all of that. And then I went into, they have the apartheid museum, like the actual, like, it's this huge, huge space. And they show, like, you know, you've seen pictures of like kids protesting in these enormous tanks. They had the tanks there. And so like, as a person who's 5'2", it just like, I can't believe the kids like were facing that. Like, yeah. I won't fearless, but like, you know, to have such bravery against basically the magistrates. And so really interesting. But yeah, I'm really interested in that history because I have heard many times that like the Afrikaners came over to like the South and they were like, how is Jim Crow working? And like, let's bring that over there. So in so many places, I think basically I really enjoyed day like in Soweto. I've been to the Langa Township also, like really wonderful people, amazing food, like cool culture and shopping and just really great. Like, I think it would be easy to navigate with kids actually. And then I've been to Mozambique twice and like super different because they like ran their colonizers out. So like a very different vibe and like much more also like, you know, there's a street like Lenin Street and like Trotsky. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. I've never seen that. But like also like, you know, not as easy to get around without speaking Portuguese. So that was difficult, but fantastic. Like
I'm always so impressed. Chris Claremont started this trend primarily, although Stan and Jack certainly did some of it. But the idea of bringing real world examples of oppression into the X-Men as an allegory. We have a lot of examples from Operation Zero Tolerance, even going back to the 60s, I suppose, to Factor 3, although that's a different type of exploration. That's obscure. Go back to my early show if you want to hear more about it.
Yeah, I will check it out.
It's a weird story about the Cold War and mutants as the oppressed population trying to take advantage of it. It's an interesting allegory. The legacy virus, you know, whatever sense you represent. So the apartheid example is another direct one that Claremont does, just like he does with William Stryker's Church, or even, I mean, those are enough examples, but it's a consistent allegory. In the modern days, we see Krakoa and like what it would be like for a mutant nation and how the world would react. Mm-hmm. I'm always very impressed with these types of stories.
Yeah.
Genosha is a complicated place. It has a lot of history in the lore, but when we first meet it in this storyline, it's just kind of simple and it looks like it's something green and beautiful on the surface, but it's very scary underneath. We open the story with a man who is a slave, a white blonde slave, which is already getting the white readers to feel something, running away from Genosha while carrying a baby. He puts the baby in a plane and basically does that like Superman get to safety thing, but then he's killed and they think the baby's dead, but the baby gets out. It then hits the newspapers, right? This is the child. I don't know if you've seen The Handmaid's Tale. This is the child out of Gilead.
God,
and they have to
that.
Yeah, it's that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. We then move to Australia where the members of the press gang are talking and they're going after this child. These people are not authorized to operate in other countries, but again, it's got that Gilead feel to it. Yep. They're going to go in with guns and do what they got to do. We got a guy named Pipeline who is a mutant teleporter, Hawkshaw who has like special senses and can detect mutants, and Punch Out. She's wearing like green, like sports clothes and like bouncing a ball against the wall. She's very, we don't have a lot about her personality. She's ruthless. She's determined. She doesn't have a lot of patience. That's kind of all that stands out.
Yeah.
As we read their initial speeches, Pipeline says, "Orders are, when this job's done, we're to collect the Gen Joke baby and return it home as well. Funny, you know, I thought muties weren't allowed to breed." And Hawkshaw says, "Accidents will happen, Pipeline. Mutie has a kid or a government minister has a mutie kid. It's all the same." Pipeline says, "I suppose. You know, Hawkshaw, that Jennifer Ransome doesn't look like any mutie." We'll talk about her in just a moment.
Yeah.
Hawkshaw says, "They don't all have horns and tails, doofus." Pipeline says, "I read her dossier, you know. She's a nice kid. Shame this has to happen."
You know, it's interesting because they're mutants and they refer to others as mutants. Like, they don't refer to themselves.
As breeders, yeah.
Yeah. Really, like, kind of removing themselves.
Punch-Out says, "Give me a break. She's only herself to blame. She knew the law. She knew her duty. But she tried to hide her test results. Then she fled the country. How's that supposed to set an example for the rest of her generation, huh? She has no right to shirk her responsibilities, especially because of her privileged position." Hawkshaw says, "Cut the chatter, Punch Out. There's our pigeon." So they are there for the baby. They are also there for Jenny Ransome. And she is a mutant. And we find out her parents, like, disguised her results at birth for her testing, but they are after her now. And her whole life's about to change. Mm-hmm. Tell me your thoughts on this opening scene and on Jenny Ransome, if you have any.
Yeah, I feel like I can't think of any specific examples, but like that always happens that you are, you know, you hate this group of people. Or like, I would think of like the queer community, like, was it Anita Bryant who was like, "Oh my God, this is terrible." And then her granddaughter is like a lesbian. Like, after
I live in Utah where there are so many examples of bigoted Mormon leaders who have gay children. Or there's the more classic example of like the anti-gay ministers and senators who are queer themselves.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's exactly what it reminded me of. But even worse, because she didn't know what was going on. They didn't tell her, you know, and then that they would kill the whole family to make an example of them. You know, obviously they don't want anyone else to do that. And so they're really, this is all out of fear. Like, they're really afraid of like people slipping through the cracks, because she was just going to go be a nurse and not bother anyone. But it's like, even that, you know, or they said because they killed the other girl, they switched the paperwork with, and she ended up being innocent, you know. Well, it's not a crime, but like, she's innocent. And so now she has to really like atone for that. You know, it's not her fault.
When we see Jenny Ransom, she's with Madeline Pryor, who is a character that we know and love from all sorts of
things. It took me a minute to realize that's who it was.
Yeah, Jean is dead at this time, and Madeline is, well, Jean's back. Anyway, Madeline's her clone and is like living with the X-Men in Australia. That's kind of all you need. Jenny Ransom flies in with Madeline Pryor for aid to a patient, but it's a ruse from the magistrates. Hawkshot can't sense Madeline Pryor at all, and this is because Roma has cast a spell on the X-Men to make them undetectable at this time, and Madeline Pryor is one of those. So the press gang are there to bring Jenny Ransom back to Genosha. A Punch-Out is just really pissed. She picks up a whole helicopter and throws it with Madeline on board, and like, Madeline narrowly gets out as the helicopter explodes, and then they get captured, Madeline and Jenny. This is kind of Punch-Out's most impressive moment, her exploding helicopter.
Yes, it's a little overkill, but yeah.
I mean, she's a little overkill too. I suppose one of the big conversations we want to have about Punch-Out, and before we continue, she is obviously a woman of color pursuing a white woman who is an escaped slave, but she's working with white mutant men to enforce the mutant supremacy here. What are your thoughts on just the dynamics of that? I think it's kind of a smart narrative choice.
Definitely. You know, obviously they're turning that upside down from like our actual history, but it just makes me wonder, like, where is she from? Like, was she born on Genosha, or is she from somewhere else and they captured her and they said, well, you know, if you don't want to be a slave, you have to work for us. Like, that is, you know, a power dynamic that happens a lot. And so it made me wonder, where is she from? And she's really taking this power to like, it's a serious power trip that she's got.
I get the idea that Genosha has been around for a while operating like this. So I imagine she's from Genosha. I imagine she's part of this system from the beginning, you know?
Yeah.
Her quote here, "We tried to play nice, Missy. We don't want to hurt anybody, but some foolish people just won't give us any choice." So she's got some fun sarcasm to her banter, which I always enjoy. Wolverine and Rogue then go looking for Madeline. So this is where everything changes for Genosha, because the world has gone largely unaware of them, just like Wakanda has, but in a very different set of circumstances. Right. But now the X-Men know they are there. They put on disguises, they infiltrate a hospital in Sydney, they meet Punch-Out, who's in a nurse uniform, because she's there to kill the baby.
Right.
She attacks them and hurts her hand when she punches Wolverine's adamantium skull. Mm-hmm. And then this is where Rogue absorbs Punch-Out's powers. Do you want to talk about Rogue's transformation here? It's kind of great. I always love when Rogue changes forms.
Yeah, like, she just ripped out of her clothes like the Hulk, and I was like, oh, is there going to be more? I guess because she was already strong, we didn't see her take on some crazy new strength. And then, you know, homeboy like wiped out all of their powers anyway, so it was neutralized. But I was like, oh my god, that would be so cool to see what she does with that added power. And then we didn't get that.
Yeah, there's another member of the magistrates that can make you have no powers. It just like completely deletes them until you recover, which is a smart thing to do for that team. If their job is to hunt down escaped mutant slaves, like, that's a good thing to have on your side.
Is it Wipeout, or is that
Wipeout? these are like all the worst 80s names.
Truly.
Punch-Out starts to recover. She finds Rogue and Wolverine unconscious. They're taken captive. I'm glad. I don't know what this babe did to me, but I plan a payback she'll never forget if she survives. And this is the most unfortunate part of this story, because Rogue ends up in a cell where it's heavily implied that she gets sexually assaulted by multiple people. They never quite say it on the page, but she's extremely vulnerable after this. And in order to get through this adventure, she has to let the Carol Danvers part of her take over, because Rogue kind of withers inside. This is brought back later as one of the reasons why she's struggling to control her powers, because this is such a significant trauma that she faced while her powers were blocked. Mm-hmm. Did you have thoughts on that storyline? Obviously, it's a little bit more sensitive, but also really carefully told, you know?
Yeah, I thought like, okay, I didn't realize that transporting them removes their clothes. So like, you're even more vulnerable and don't want to fight back, which also made me think of like, you know, the transatlantic slave, you know, and then auctions and, you know, you're naked and all of that. But really, like, you see her are almost catatonic, and they like mention that like some people manhandled her, you know, like they tried to lessen it. And then further down, it was almost like the magistrates were threatening her with what already had happened, which made me go back to like, okay, this was probably an assault. And I feel like they handled it in a somewhat sensitive way for a comic book, but was almost kind of like brushed aside kind of quickly.
Well, we have such a long history of female characters who are subjected to sexual assault in the male gaze.
Right.
For Claremont to do this to a character when he's so careful at writing powerful women, this is a specific storyline that's talking about Rogue's vulnerability, and it's not celebrated or excused in the way that so many of those sexual assault stories are.
Right.
It's a rough story, but I think it's delicately done enough to make it okay.
Yeah.
And you also get the implication that Punch-Out wanted to get revenge on Rogue and kind of allowed the assault to take place. Did you get that vibe as you were reading?
I didn't right away, but you know, that makes sense because
she says at the end, I'm going to make her pay, right?
Right.
Yeah,
the other way. The cameras were off, all of that. It was interesting though that the man in charge was upset about it and like wanted to hold them accountable a little bit.
These are mutants that can be added to the slave cast. He hasn't determined where he wants them.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, it's a little bit rough because again, the X-Men blow shit up.
That's more coming from like she's valuable property versus like I'm empathetic with her.
Yeah, that's the vibe I got too. Yeah. So back in Australia, there are captive magistrates in jail. Psylocke is like, where are our friends? She reads their minds. Punch-Out knocks a hole in the wall in order to rescue the captured soldiers. Jenny Ransom's family back in Genosha has been kidnapped, and she has a boyfriend named Philip Moreau, who is the son of the Gene Genier, the guy that is like making the mutant slaves and mutates. And like, there's a process that you see much later in the comics for some characters where they will completely wipe their identities and program them with something new. That's a Gene Genier approach, and it's a rough story. But Philip is in love with Jenny, who is now in this awful system. Did you have thoughts on the Gene Genier? He's creepy.
It reminded me, I don't know, Twilight Zone is my favorite show of all time, and there's an episode called Number 12 Looks Just Like You, where you reach a certain age of maturity, and then like you're born and you look like whatever, but there are 12 like male and female bodies and faces that they transform people into so that there's like a standard of beauty, and you have to choose one of them. Or like there's all this crap about like, oh, it's your choice, and like you don't have to worry about it. And there's a young girl who's really resisting, and her father was kind of like against the system and read a lot of books, which they're also frowning upon. And so by the end of it, they just kind of wear her down to the point where she does it. And no personality, no real memory of what's happening, no like real emotions, you know, they're kind of drugging themselves. It's like a really deep parable. And it reminded me like, that's exactly the process they're putting them through.
It's a lot to reckon with this story, but we love these serious themes in our X-Men.
Yeah.
Watching X-Men 97 with my children, and there's the genocide episode, and I knew it was coming. And it's just, you know, that identity piece is so crazy. In 237, we have an informational speech that Genosha has released. I'm going to read this out loud because it's interesting, the insight of the way the country presents itself. Genosha, our green and pleasant land, an informatate brought to you by the Ministry of Public Information. Ours is an island located off the East African coast, midway between Madagascar and the Seychelles. Used originally, and for centuries, as a haven for Indian Ocean corsairs and rumored to be the destination of one of Sinbad the Sailor's legendary voyages, it was settled during the great ages of exploration. The superb national anchorage at Hammer Bay formed the foundation of our commerce, and trade was our initial source of wealth. Until the discovery of iron ore and other precious metals in the Ridgeback Mountains, iron which is processed into the finest steel available on Earth, with an absolute minimum of pollution and at a cost that cannot be beat. Over the years, Genosha has built an economy and society that is the envy of the world. There is no poverty here, no hardship with unparalleled opportunities for education and employment. Ours is a free land where people are judged by deeds and character, not by the color of their skin. Our industrial base is currently diversifying into computer sciences and space technology, putting Genosha in the forefront of those nations racing eagerly towards the 21st century. And we are self-sufficient in agriculture, with farmland so beautiful, they one day may challenge America's Midwest for the title breadbasket to the world. I have to assume this is based on kind of how South Africa was presenting itself.
Absolutely.
In the 80s.
Yeah, that board of tourism whole advertisements.
I haven't seen any of those. Have you?
I can see. Yeah, I've actually was just reading something like last month, and they were talking about how they were actually advertising specifically to white folks in the South here. year to go there for vacation because it's like, oh, this is like the kind of lifestyle you missed almost. And it's super interesting.
It's really, really interesting and very smartly written once again. You can do a lot with just a couple of text bubbles. So by the time everything ends, Jenny Ransom and Philip Moreau end up leaving Genosha with the X-Men. We see them in sporadically throughout X-Men comics over the next 30 years or so. They're not frequently used characters, but they do bring them back from time to time. The Genosians are still after her in Uncanny X-Men 264. They kill cops in America. They try to kill Forge. Charlotte Jones is there. Again, go see my episode about Charlotte. They punch out on Hawkshaw, teleport to the States via pipeline to get her, and they end up right on X-Factor's sentient celestial ship. Beast is there to stand against them, and punch out socks Beast in the jaw, and Beast hides. Jean Grey and Banshee are also there. Punch out manages to slip a control collar, which they call a baffler, around Jean's head to mess up her telepathy. She goes, the harder you struggle, hon, the more that baffler headband scrambles your synapses, so you can't even control your bod, much less your telekinesis. Fair warning, keep it up, you can do yourself some permanent damage. She also says, Red's an old play, yes? Founding member of the Jean Joke gang. We play a bit with her, betcha Fuzzy comes a-running. So Beast ends up kicking Punch Out in the face. What a perspicacious soul you are, my dear, he says.
Vocabulary.
Ship wakes up and like restrains Punch Out. The magistrates are arrested and they have diplomatic immunity, so they are basically just let go.
Yeah.
Punch Out returns again, basically in three more stories. I'm going to cover these relatively quickly. Mm-hmm. Back in the Extinction Agenda briefly, this is the giant X-Men storyline that goes over like 18 parts and changes the whole franchise. Storm and Wolfsbane get made into mutates as examples, and like Warlock dies at the end. It's really consequential. Punch-Out kind of just briefly shows up. The press gang's there. They don't have a lot to do. Then flash forward to a story a lot of people don't remember, which is Cable 26 through 28. We're back in Genosha. There is a war. The press gang are in their headquarters ranting about how they lost their easy life and they just want it back. Mm-hmm. Hawkshaw says, as soon as we kill every rebel and put those Jean jokes back in their place. Punch-Out takes a call for an assignment. They end up finding the rebel cell of Jenny and Philip, but Cable and Domino are there. Jenny gets one good punch to Punch-Out's jaw, but then like they just teleport out of there. That's basically all that happens. Hearing them kind of reminisce about their easy life while they're fighting insurrection in the country. We also learn in this storyline that the Sugar Man is behind Genosha. He's the man behind the man. Are you familiar with the Sugar Man?
I don't think I know that guy.
In this could be really complicated. There's a story in the 90s where the son of Xavier, Legion, goes back in time and accidentally kills his father. Mm-hmm. And there's a world called the Age of Apocalypse where Magneto forms the X-Men instead of Xavier. One of the villains in this story is a weird dude with a giant face and little arms and a big pointy tongue. He's really horrific.
Yeah.
Awful. He's like a nightmare boogeyman character. But when the reality resets, he ends up coming back to our reality, but 20 years in the past. So the retcon here is that he was there making Genosha happen with the Jean Genier the whole time, which doesn't really matter a whole bunch, but it's an interesting retcon.
Very.
The last appearance is Fantastic Four Volume 3, 10 and 12. This is where Claremont was writing the FF. There's a super scientist named the Crucible, who's one of the Enclave. He's in Genosha experimenting on mutants and humans. The press gang, including Ransom now, go to America to kidnap Mr. Fantastic so that he can help defeat the Crucible. Mm-hmm. Jenny being on this team is really weird. They have to be brainwashing her somehow. Punch-Out is like buddies with Jenny here now. She's initially knocked into the water by Mr. Fantastic. They get him back to Genosha. There's a big story, but Punch-Out's not really in the rest. So that's kind of the end of this character. We haven't seen her around much, although we've seen a ton of Genosha. Magneto ruled it. We had the side happen. We've had like Zombie Island over there. Where do you think this character is? What happened to her after the fall of her government?
Good question. You know, if I were her, I'd be under the radar because I probably pissed off a lot of people over the past 40 or 50 years. I feel like it's clear that Chris liked her if he took her to another franchise. I've actually never read an episode of Fantastic Four, but it makes me wonder, did he have bigger plans or want to do more with that group or with her in particular? Because it seems really obscure to bring her back, even like talking about Genosha. I don't know. It makes me wonder, where is Genosha right now? Like, are they ruled by mutants? Because maybe she's just living there and she's got a little condo and she's trying to like have a normal, regular life.
I bet it's very like post-World War II Nazi. Like she's living in Argentina under an assumed name.
That's probably most likely.
This character's interesting because she's so very 80s with a name like Punch Out, but what she represents for the government as a woman of color is kind of an awful character. Not that we've been given much of her interior life by any means. I like a villain, but I like a little complexity to my villain. And she comes across as a little bit one note. She's got a revenge streak and a level of cruelty to her, but she's also all business. Like, give me my paycheck and get out of my way. And I'm there to support that piece. But not when it involves slavery. That's less
okay. I wish they would have given like one little bubble of like what her life was like. Maybe she's doing this to support her family somewhere. Who knows, you know? But absolutely no idea. Like where she came from would be nice to know. The whole press gang, actually, like they should bring them back and talk about what happened or where they are.
It's a lot to consider the amount of characters that have never had the opportunity to shine. But I think this is a character that has a ton of potential. Do you know the character Frenzy at all?
I have heard Frenzy and I'm trying to remember what she looks like.
Frenzy shows up. She kind of looks like Punch Out. Frenzy shows up in the early 80s as an X-Factor villain. It's a weird story because you know Apocalypse, of course.
Yeah.
Apocalypse in his first appearance is employing a mutant who gives you boosts that make you feel like you're on drugs. You get addicted to his boosts. And there's a group of characters that are serving Apocalypse so that they can keep getting their fix. One of them is a black woman named Frenzy. Her real name is Joanna Cargill. Mm-hmm. And she's dressed in leather and she looks like She-Hulk, except she's black and she's amazing.
She's got braids, yeah.
But it's also like kind of problematic, you know, except that it's a whole team of people. She goes on to become a really prominent character when Magneto's leading the Acolytes.
Okay.
And then later she joins the X-Men for an extended period. She's been featured on Krakoa a lot. She's an ambassador. She's had a love story with a Skrull. Like do you follow Stephanie Williams at all?
No.
Stephanie Williams is a black female writer who recently gave us a short Frenzy story about like, she's like, I am tired. I work all the time and I'm tired. And I'm like, Stephanie, this is you speaking to us directly.
Yeah, definitely.
Frenzy is a contemporary of Punch Out, but she's had an opportunity to glow up in a way that Punch Out never.
Yeah.
You know?
Is this who the brown girl and the new like prequel X-Men on Michael Fassbender, like there's like a brown girl next to him, right? Am I making that up? Was there
somebody? I don't know this reference, I don't think.
Or I'm trying to think, maybe it was the one with Ian McKellen where there was like a black girl on his team, but I don't think they said her name. They never said her name, and I wonder if that's who that's supposed to be.
I don't know if I know this character at all, actually. I would love to see Punch Out back. I would love to, even with just a couple of word balloons, maybe she comes across a superhero while she's doing something and like tries to run for it, and we just learn a little bit of context. I think even just one line of her expressing regret would completely change this character. To say out loud, I'm sorry about what happened and I don't feel like I can ever make up for it. You know, that type of thing, even if she remains a villain, I think that would be really interesting. We have seen Hawkshaw and Pipeline and Wipeout and, you know, the others a couple of times, but she just faded away in some ways.
Thought she was too problematic to bring back.
Maybe, but I'm actually really pleased they put a woman of color on this team.
Yeah.
I think it adds a level of complexity to the conversation about apartheid that's really interesting because it makes white readers tune in a particular way. At least
absolutely. And I mean, anywhere you're doing these kind of systems, like there's going to be everybody involved. And anytime you can like get out of being oppressed and like, you know, do your part to support whatever oppressors, like always happens.
Raisa, what a joy to meet you. We've been interacting for so long. It's so nice to have a face with the name. I'm going to be in San Diego at the end of July. I'd love to grab a cup of coffee or hang out. I'm going to go down to the con if you're in the area. Let's stay in touch.
I was so excited. I bought Comic-Con tickets. I finally got them and I was supposed to go July 2020, so obviously that didn't happen. And then the following year they let us use it, but I couldn't go. And so I almost feel like I've given up, but I feel like next year is my year. I'll finally go.
But if you're in the area,
I do plan to be in LA.
I have to stay in that San Diego box.
Sure.
I flew there, you know, but yeah, if you happen to be down there, I'd love to catch up.
Yeah.
But I'm in LA otherwise. As we are wrapping up, if you have any final thoughts on Punch Out, I'd love to hear them. And tell people where they could find you if you'd like to be followed. And anything you'd like to plug, we're going to put this out in mid-July.
Well, I feel like now I need to do a Punch Out like burlesque routine.
And everyone would be like, who is like, that? But you look amazing.
Is that? What is she doing? So I'm going to have to get ripped or get like the fake muscle suit. I really want her to pop up again. I'm kind of curious like what they could do with her. And also just in general, I don't know enough about Genosha. So I've been wanting to get back into comics. And I feel like so much has happened since I bought a comic that is like really intimidating. I go into the store and I'm like, where even are they now? So I know Krakoa ended. I didn't read any of that. So maybe I'll start there and then just kind of go from there. Actually, you know, just bought a book.
You kind of just have to pick a series and enjoy one corner, because if you get too involved, suddenly you're hundreds of books behind and it gets overwhelming. I would be happy to recommend like a shorter run or a particular era for you as you kind of just dive in, you know?
Just bought this, so I'm blurry, so it's not going to show it. But
what is it?
It's the Green Lantern that's like the black woman.
Oh yeah,
it's super blurry. I've never read a Green Lantern. I've never purchased anything DC. I'm very.
Yeah, but if you get a trade paper like that, that it's a story front to back, and you know there's more before, and you know there's more after, but you just get
exactly.
You know.
So I need to get some X-Men like this, so I can just like see a chunk of what happened at a time. So thank you for sending me those, because that was really cool.
Absolutely.
I want to read more about Genosha for sure. I find it super interesting.
Here's where X-Men can go crazy sci-fi once in a while. During the Krakoa era, Genosha was the massacre of 16 million mutants. And a whole bunch of effort has been, you know, put into reclaiming, but it just never quite works out.
Yeah.
There's a storyline in Genosha in Steve Orlando's Marauders where, oversimplifying, but they take all the DNA from the mutants who died and take it back like 2 billion years and seed something that ends up becoming a mutant civilization.
Interesting.
Now that mutant civilization eventually expires, but part of that civilization goes on to become Krakoa, which is where the X-Men find their land. It's a really, I'm oversimplifying, very sci-fi.
That's super sci-fi.
Yeah, Genosha has a lot of resonance in the comics as like the scene of the genocide. You know, it's really powerful. What a delight.
How much further is that from this? Like, this is this the first?
So the story we read is 1988.
Okay.
Magneto rules Genosha in like the late 90s, early 2000s.
Okay.
The storyline I just referenced happened like last year.
Oh wow. Okay.
It's an ongoing saga.
Okay. There's a lot to catch up on. But yeah, I adore it, and I adore all of these characters, and so I'm definitely gonna get back into it.
Excellent.
And you can follow me on Instagram. My first and last name is my Instagram. So
I will tag you. What a joy, and I'm happy to chat anytime. You're delightful.
You're in Utah?
Mm-hmm, Salt Lake City.
Okay. One of my best friends just like moved last year back to Park City. She's from there. So I'm going to visit her. So when I'm there, I'll reach out.
Yeah, that's easy for us. We can get together there. Park City is like a 20-minute drive up the mountain.
That's probably very close. Yeah, okay. Yeah, she's been begging me to come out.
Salt Lake is about 500,000 people if you take the whole geographic region. And then there's like 30 minutes of passing through the mountains, and Park City is like a little more resorty, rich town just up the way where they have ski.
She didn't mention that.
Yeah, it's the kind of place where like you'll see some white women sitting on the front porch with a glass of wine at 6 p.m. as they look at their art inside. Nice. You know,
sign me up.
It's pretty nice. It's also where they have Sundance, which is what makes it insane.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Well, lastly, I'm Chad Anderson. I keep my own social media private because I got kiddos. You're welcome to add me if you'd like, Raisa.
Sure.
You can follow Gray Malkin Lane, Gray_Malkin_Lane on Instagram. On the show, we're going to keep going through the original Necra storylines from the early 70s, and look for a Charlotte Jones episode out here on this channel next week. So thanks everybody for listening. Thank you, Raisa. We'll see you all back here next time on the Gray Malkin Lane Patreon.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again. You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.